Good afternoon. The time is 2 o'clock. Welcome to Vox Pop for this Wednesday, July 23rd. I'm Ray Graff. Today we welcome author, radio engineer, NYSDEC outdoor guide Glenn Kreisberg. Glenn researches archaeoastronomy and landscape archaeology in the Hudson Valley and Catskill Mountains. He is the author of Spirits in Stone, which is a fascinating, richly illustrated study of ceremonial stone landscapes in Northeast America and the relationship to other sites around the world. We'll meet Glenn today, find out more about his research, and take your calls. 800-348-2551 is the number, 1-800-348-2551. You can also email us at voxpop@wamc.org. Glenn Kreisberg and your calls coming up after the news. Hello once again. Welcome back to Vox Pop, WAMC's live afternoon call-in talk show. I'm Ray Graff. Joining us today is archaeoastronomy and landscape archaeology researcher Glenn Kreisberg. According to Glenn's book, Spirits in Stone, there exists in the Northeast a large number of standing stone structures that have been mostly ignored by conventional archaeologists and historians, often dismissed as stone walls and field-clearing piles from early European and colonial-era settlers. Kreisberg says these formations are increasingly emerging as part of something else. He served two terms as first vice president of the New England Antiquities Research Association, is co-founder of the nonprofit Overlook Mountain Center in Woodstock, New York. He has appeared on the History Channel. It's a pleasure to welcome him to the show today. If you have a question as we roll along, just give us a shout. 800-348-2551. 1-800-348-2551. If you're uninitiated, it might take a little while to figure out what we're talking about. But by 15, 20 minutes in, give us a shout. You can email us at voxpop@wamc.org. Glenn Kreisberg, welcome to the show.
Thanks, Ray. Thanks for having me.
So funny how this appearance happened. I was on with our historian friend, Kathy Sheehan, several months ago, and I had just kind of offhandedly mentioned that for the first time since I was a kid, I was a passenger in a vehicle on the Taconic Parkway. And I had a chance to really look at some of these, and they've always caught my attention, these stone walls that you see in, I guess, Columbia and Dutchess County, for the most part, probably elsewhere. And you called in the show and said, I wrote a book about it. And I said, yeah, I have the book. So let's talk about what you do, first of all, and how you ended up in this interesting research field.
Well, as you mentioned, I'm a radio frequency engineer by trade, so I work on building the network that we all use for sharing and storing and getting access to the information that's so important to all of us. I was lucky enough as a young adult to work in a bookstore in Woodstock, New York, called the Three Geese in Flight Bookstore. It's no longer there, but it's still online. My dear friend Sam Wenger owned that, and as a young person, I read a lot about ancient history and ancient mythology. His book specialized in rare, out-of-date, antiquarian books, things like Arthurian legend. And so I read people like Barry Fell and America B.C. and Saga Americana, and I just learned and absorbed a lot about ancient culture and traditions. And then, because of my career as a radio frequency engineer, I was asked to sit on a siting committee for a cell tower in Woodstock. And people showed up at the public hearing talking about these things in the woods that they saw that they thought was important. And it all ended up getting dismissed by the historians. But what struck me is, here's this ancient mystery. I'm a big lover of ancient mysteries, and here was one right in our own backyard that seemed to me worthy of investigating.
You have done, and your book is so filled with great pictures from Overlook and all these other places in the Hudson Valley where these stone piles and stone walls exist and other stone structures that we'll get into later. It's so full of all those things. It's remarkable that in Europe there are a lot of these sites. And some archaeologists will say, well, you're nuts, man. These are not things that were put here by people. But they look an awful lot like things that were put here by people in Europe, in the Southwest, and of this country, and other places. It seems like the Northeast has not had a real focus on this before.
Well, it's not in any of the textbooks, and that's kind of the controversial part of what I've put out here in my work. And it's not generally accepted that the Native Americans in the Northeast really did anything with stone as far as building or constructing or, you know, let alone aligning their constructions to events on the horizon, which is what we're talking about when we talk about archaeoastronomy. And maybe just for your listeners, we can do a little baseline of what that
Great
is.
Idea.
And archaeoastronomy, landscape archaeology, you know, what are those things? And archaeoastronomy, you can think of in simple terms of how ancient people used the sky, looked at the sky, and how they incorporated what they viewed and observed into their worldview. And if you think of landscape as representing a living synthesis between people and the land that they inhabit, and then a skyscape being a landscape from which, that contains a landscape that contains a portion of the sky or horizon from which cultural stories can be constructed. That kind of ties together those two concepts of archaeoastronomy and landscape archaeology.
How I can understand that we today can make the connection and say, well, I can see how this would be connected to astronomy or the constellations or a winding wall, stone wall, which we'll talk about in a few, could be an effigy of a snake. How do you prove that?
Well, it's actually archaeoastronomy is pretty objective. The numbers are the numbers. If things line up and point to a certain azimuth on the horizon, you can't really dispute that. No, it's a question of interpretation. You can say, well, that's happenstance or just fortuitous that that lines up. But if you see a pattern of this, that's what really helps validate the concept. And what I did with my research in the Catskills and the Hudson Valley is I took a locational or a GIS approach to it. I plotted out where all these things were on the landscape. I made a big spreadsheet, listed all the features. This allows you to sort and filter and look for patterns. And one of the patterns we saw is a lot of these sites align along certain azimuths that point to winter solstice sunrise and summer solstice sunset, or summer solstice sunrise and winter solstice sunset, and also the equinoxes, which are right in the middle. So when you see this pattern and it's pervasive, you can't really ignore it. You know, there's something there.
Some of these are natural there's a Montauk line, right? And you talk about this in your book, right? A long line of sites which you say are archaeoastronomy sites or sacred sites for Native Americans, right? And it goes from Montauk on Long Island all the way out to Michigan, right?
So you're talking about what we call the Hammonasset line.
Correct,
that's right. A researcher named Tom Paul, who no longer is with us and lived in Connecticut, he kind of rediscovered this line, which originates, as you say, on Montauk at a place called Council Rock in a cemetery in Fort Pond. And you can go on Google Earth and you can see this large monolith in the middle of this cemetery. And it turns out that that large monolith aligns with a large monolith up here in the Catskill Mountains known as Devil's Tombstone. And just as a side note, things with the name Devil, that usually connotates the place that Native Americans conducted spiritual or ceremonial activity. And as the settlers came in the early colonial times, they would see that activity and they would, you know, good Calvinist and Puritan Dutch would say, oh, that's the devil's work and devil worship. And that's how many of our locations, like Devil's Kitchen, you know,
Dance Camera
Point, Devil's Path, Devil's Acre. There's a lot of devils in the Catskills, and most of that is a clue to some of this activity.
Let's take a break here real quick. 800-348-2551. Glenn Kreisberg is our guest. He is the author of Spirits in Stone, a really interesting read. We'll try to dig deeper into this as we go along, and we'll take your calls as well. You can email voxpop@wamc.org. Little Zappa, we'll be back. Zappa, eat that question here on Vox Pop. 800-348-2551 is our number. Ray Graff with you, joined today by Glenn Kreisberg, who is the author of Spirits in Stone. There's another one coming, which we'll get to in a little bit. But let's go back to those stone walls that piqued my interest several months ago. There's got to be a way to see. I mean, my first inclination was, okay, these are colonial era or late 17, early 1800 era boundary markers. There has to be a way to go through records and look at this and verify it.
Well, first I should say that many of them are early American or colonial and are from that period. But I like to cite a survey that was done as part of the 1880 U.S. Census.
Okay. And,
leading up to 1880, they did a survey, what was called Stone Fence Survey of New England. So it was the New England states that didn't really include our area. But what they found and documented and recorded were over 240,000 miles of constructed stone walls and stonework in the New England area. So if you think about that, it's a little mind-blowing, 240,000 miles of wall. That's like enough wall to reach to the moon or to wrap around the earth 10 times.
It's a lot of stone.
It's a lot of stone. And it's a little counter-logical or counterintuitive to think all of that could have been built entirely in, say, the 200-year period of 1680 to 1880 when this survey was concluded. So, you know, you just can't imagine that there was a culture here, a civilization here, for 10,000 years that didn't leave some kind of footprint on the landscape. And if part of that footprint was helping them express their belief system, then some of it may remain and should be recognized and identified in its proper cultural context.
Deeds would be another place to look, right? For old, old deeds.
So it's really a resource project for each one of these site locations because they're all on different property. They all have a different land history. And you do. You start by going to your county real property tax office, looking at the deed of land for the property that you're curious about, where you might find some of these features. And really, nobody can go walking in the woods in our area without, I'm a state-licensed outdoor guide, so I spend a lot of time in the backcountry, off-trail, bushwhacking. And no matter where you go, you find these unusual stone features. And sometimes it's a cellar hole, you know, it's an old farmstead or stone walls. But sometimes you find really odd things like perched boulders. And, you know, sometimes in the early land deeds, once you start researching them going back, you know, from the computer-generated ones to the hand typewritten ones to the handwritten ones.
Right.
You find mention of ancient stone monuments. And we did find those up in Woodstock on the Lewis Hollow site. There were subdivisions that were identified that took place between Robert Livingston and Cornelius Hardenberg of the Hardenberg patent. And in these handwritten deeds, you saw mentions of ancient stone monuments that the surveyors, you know, happened upon. And they're, oh, that's, you know, that we'll use that as a marker. We'll put a pipe in there. But unless they are delineating a property boundary that's clear and on record, you know, if it's not a property boundary and you keep going back in the deeds and it's not identified as a property boundary, then it's something else. It's almost an exercise in process of elimination. You know, was there a farmstead? Did they farm the land and clear it? And of course, much of that happened all throughout our region.
You know, in reading your book, I'm struck by the fact that so much of this is murky. And by the way, our guest is Glenn Kreisberg. His book is Spirits in Stone. The number is 800-348-2551. We'll get to the phone calls in a moment. I'm struck by how much of this is murky. For instance, down in Putnam County, there are these, and this has been on TV. I'm sure you've been on History Channel with regard to some of these dugouts. No, they're not dugouts. They're beautiful stone
chambers. The megalithic stone chambers of Putnam.
And there are more than one down there.
Hundreds of them. 320, over 320 have been recorded.
What do we know about the history post-Henry Hudson of those? Were they recorded?
I mean, some of them were. When landowners moved into that area and started farming, many of these were converted. They were already there. They're noted again. They're noted in deeds. But many of them were converted into root cellars. And, you know, I toured a bunch of these stone chambers probably 10 or 15 years ago with members of the New York State Museum. They had never seen them. And, you know, they were extremely curious. And I think they had always just assumed that they were earlier colonial American. But when you look at these things, they're megalithic.
They're cool.
There's nothing like them. Now, there have been theories that maybe they were magazine chambers for storing gunpowder during the Revolutionary War, things like that. But many of the entrances are oriented to winter solstice sunrise or the equinox, and that's intentional. That's not just an accident.
How do you know?
Well, you don't, but there's a pattern of it. And if you look back in time and you go to other cultures around the world, this is something that's almost ubiquitous, building architecture that aligns with solstice sunrises and equinox sunrises on the horizon on the longest and shortest days of the year. These were, these celebrations were the first holidays, holy days, that humans probably celebrated going back to the earliest times of humanity. And really, you know, if you think about it, and there's a wonderful book called Hamlet's Mill, written by two MIT scholars, Hertha von Deutschen and Giorgio De Santolini. And in Hamlet's Mill, they postulate that the single greatest preoccupation of pre-literate humans was looking up at the sky and keeping track of the movements and understanding those patterns that repeated themselves in the sky. So it was obviously very important to ancient people, including Native Americans.
Our guest today is Glenn Kreisberg. The book is Spirits in Stone. The number is 800-348-2551. The email address is voxpop@wamc.org. Bear in Beacon writes in, does Glenn know anything about the Standing Stone in Wappinger Falls by the Mount Alvernia, I'm reading from my phone and my eyesight's cruddy, and PTC monasteries on Delavergne Ave. Does it align to anything in the sky? Do you know anything about these in Wappinger's Falls?
I do know about that stone. That stone was featured on the cover of one of the versions of Salvador Trento's book. Salvador Trento wrote a book called The Search for Ancient America, and it had a picture of that standing stone in Wappinger's on the cover. So that's an important stone. It is marks a travel way to the Wappinger's Creek, to the mouth of the Wappinger's Creek. And it's, you go to look at this thing and you can find it on Google Earth. It's very underwhelming. It's about 4 feet tall. But it, according to some of the research done on that stone, when the development was made there, half of that stone was buried. So at one point it might have been 10 feet tall.
That's a problem, obviously, everywhere, and I'm sure in Europe as well. But here, so much of this land was bulldozed or gone. So who knows what was here prior to that?
And that it's a tragedy, and it's also an unknown. We know that there's an unknown that we'll never know because so much of this stuff was destroyed.
I love the description in your book about Henry Hudson coming up the Hudson. Right, I think it was right by Wappinger's Creek, where they saw the Native Americans dancing, and it was that's how the Danskammer name got there, right?
That is mentioned in Jewett's log. He was the first mate on Henry Hudson's third voyage on the Half Moon, and as they sailed up about a day's sail from Manhattan north, they encountered a ceremony taking place, and this was early September. It may have been the early corn ceremony, but the Native Americans were dancing around rings of fire with their bodies painted, and this was noted by the crew as they probably sailed silently past at night. And they gave it the name Danskammer Point, Devil's Dance Chamber, because they saw Native Americans doing ceremony there and, of course, labeled it as devil worship.
Is there a chamber there?
There isn't, but that's what gained my interest, or there's no evidence that there was ever a chamber there. They just used that word Danskammer, which is dance chamber in Dutch.
Now we get into the archaeoastronomy again, because there's an alignment there at that point, right?
Very much so, and I think this is why it was a very important ceremony site for Native Americans, is because that point of land on the Hudson aligns with the mouth of the Wappinger's Creek about a mile across and a slightly north at an angle that is precisely the summer solstice sunrise. And again, from the mouth of the creek over the point of land, it would be the winter solstice sunset. And what's really fascinating is after, on the evening of the summer solstice, what rises in that position is the Pleiades, the star cluster that comes over the horizon in the spot where the sun came over in the morning. And the Pleiades was a very important constellation to Native American tribes because they timed their agriculture and their planting and their harvesting, and they used that as a marker in the sky to know when to do such.
You know, there is so much to talk about in this book, but we got to hit the phones here. Glenn Kreisberg is our guest. The book is Spirits in Stone, and let's go to the phones. We'll begin with our buddy Joan in Schenectady. Joan, you're on.
Hey, thanks, Ray. And I want to say you sound so Ray, you sound great.
Oh, thank
I'm
you.
Speaking to your guest.
Oh.
Your intelligence is palpable over the radio waves. Thank you.
Oh. Okay.
Mine or yours, Ray?
No, not me. I'm a dope, and it's well known.
Oh, he knows. Yeah. I'm just, I'll say with the rest of us, it's good to hear you rested, Ray.
Hey, I read Glenn's book on my week up in Maine, and so.
Oh, really?
Yeah, I'm pretty jazzed up about it. So go ahead. You have a question for Glenn?
Yes. I'm more familiar with the Adirondacks than the Catskills. I do a lot of hiking. And we have up in the Adirondacks tons of glacial erratics. And they seem out of place, but, you know, they say the ice moved it and all of that. I do want to say the few times I've hiked in the Catskills, there is a more, I want to say eerie feeling when you're at, like, I think I went through some place called Devil's Notch, and everything of it is, it just kind of makes your skin tingle. So I really do believe that these lands were used for quite some time. How do you tell the difference between a glacial erratic and a farmer's stone wall and an effigy of a snake? How do you guys figure this out?
I love this, because I talked to geologist Ed Stander about just that, before vacation during the science forum or during one of the breaks. I said, you know, there are these glacial erratics, and some of them are sitting on other stones, and it looks almost purposeful. Mm-hmm. So, Glenn, how do you separate that, or even can you?
Well, it is difficult to date these types of stone structures because you can't get any organic matter unless there's organic matter, a fire pit, or something nearby that you can date using traditional carbon-14 dating. It's difficult to get a handle on dates. There is some new technology known as optical stimulated luminescence, which is a type of dating methodology that's somewhat new. But when it comes to these glacier erratics, one of the things that I found is a pattern that many of them are oriented to the cardinal directions, and they're also oriented to one another over distances at the angle or the azimuth of the winter solstice sunrise or summer solstice sunset. So you got to really do a study. You got to take a compass out into the woods. You've got to see where these things are pointed to, how they're oriented, whether they may have been manipulated. Again, this would be in the category of landscape archaeology, where you take natural elements found in your environment and you manipulate it, you change it, you accentuate or exaggerate or move it around in a way where it helps, represent your worldview. And I think this is what we see in the Catskills. We see many of these large boulders, some of them identify as dolmen because, as Ray points out, they're set up on smaller stones beneath them. And now a geologist will tell you that's just the way it melted out of the glacier.
Right.
And that's quite possible. But you can't preclude the possibility that ancient people during the 10 or 12,000, it keeps getting pushed further back and back, 10, 15, 20,000 years ago, there were people in this continent, and they were moving things around as it suited their purpose.
Joan, thanks a lot for the call. Number here is 800-348-2551. Glenn Kreisberg is our guest today. Spirits in Stone is the book. Let's go to Sandusfield. Ronald, you're on.
Yes, good afternoon. This is a coincidence because Saturday morning I'm going to be giving a talk in our town here about ceremonial stone landscapes. And my objective is to raise awareness among the landowners, especially that they won't be able to look at their woods in the same way. And I'm going to try to differentiate between these farmers' walls, for example, and the many walls to nowhere that we find all over the place here.
Okay.
Very good. And I applaud you for helping raise awareness. And ceremonial stone landscapes are not something that's on everybody's radar. Cultural stone landscapes, there's a difference. Every ceremonial landscape is a cultural stone landscape, but not every cultural stone landscape is a ceremonial stone landscape. If you think about quarrying, that's a landscape that's been altered, but there's probably no ceremonial aspect to it. Whereas cultural stone landscapes are places where Native Americans themselves, and what I'm going to do, I'm going to read real briefly here from a resolution that was passed by the United Southern and Eastern Tribes in 2007, and you can look this up online. And stating from the resolution, it says, for thousands of years before immigrations of Europeans, the medicine people of the Uset tribal ancestors used these sacred landscapes to sustain the people's reliance on Mother Earth and spirit energies of balance and harmony. And whether these stone structures are massive or small structures, stacked or stone rows or effigies, these prayers in stone are often mistaken by archaeologists and state historic preservation officers as the efforts of farmers clearing stones for agricultural or wall building purposes. So everything gets kind of put in one bucket and it's not generally recognized or accepted that some of these are, in fact, Native American. But here you have a resolution by a group of Native American tribes who are recognizing this.
Was that with regard to Hadley? Wasn't there a circle in Massachusetts? I thought it was in Hadley.
There is a
maybe not Hadley.
No, but there is that resolution was it took a few years later, but in 2010, the first ceremonial landscape was federally recognized in Turner's Falls.
Turner's Falls, that's it.
Where the airport was looking to be extended into the woods, and they identified stone piles and walls that Native Americans stepped forward and said, these belong to us, they're important and ceremonial. Even though the state archaeologists dismissed that, the federal archaeologists and the Park Service and Department of Interior overruled.
And that was kind of a big deal.
It was, because that was the first federally recognized ceremonial landscape in the Northeast.
And before we jump to Frank and Ann Adams, just quickly, just let's talk about Fort Drum and the significance of what went on up there.
Thanks for bringing that up. And that is actually related to the conference that took place at Colgate University about 10 years ago. If you look up the Stars and Stone Symposium, Lori Rush, who's the cultural resource manager, the archaeologist for the Army up at Fort Drum, was contacted by people who were working on a project on the fort, and they found unusual stone features that turned out to be a ceremonial landscape. They did the proper thing. They consulted with federally recognized tribes who came in. Their tribal preservation office looked at what they had, and there were alignments that were astronomical. So what Lori Rush did was she contacted Anthony Avini at Colgate University, and Tony Avini is probably America's premier archaeoastronomer, but he did all his work in Central America, Mexico, South America, you know, the Mesoamerican area. Mm-hmm. And everywhere in the Americas, except the Northeast, there are these astronomical alignments. So Anthony Avini was kind of blown away, and he said, well, we better have a symposium. And it was a watershed moment because you had three groups in the same room at the same time. And actually, this was held at the Tung Ho Visualization Center, which is like a mini high-tech planetarium that they have at Colgate, where they can recreate anything in the sky going back tens of thousands of years. And you had the academics from Colgate and Avini and archaeologists, but you also had the state and federal regulators from the state office
of Parks. And the tribal elders, too, from Canada.
And you had the tribal, that was the third group, and they were all there together talking about these things. And the takeaway was that a lot of the federal and state regulators had to admit that none of this was on their radar, that they had no sensitivity to it before this was brought to their attention. So that was important.
Glenn Kreisberg is our guest today. Spirits and Stone is the book. 800-348-2551 is the number. Frank is in Adams. Frank, go ahead.
How are you? I can't believe. Are you reading my mind? You just mentioned it's South Hadley.
Ah.
I can't believe you said that. But there is a circle of stones. It's not too far from Mount Holyoke.
Uh-huh.
Mount Holyoke College. See, I was a courier. This is going back 15 years. Used to deliver in the daytime. This is a true story now. I mean, it goes into stones, yes. But I went into a Dunkin' Donuts right about a half a mile from the campus of Mount Holyoke. And this is, I'd say, 15, maybe 16 years ago. A little girl worked behind the counter. I thought she said, what did you do, see a mouse? Says, no, I saw, this is a true story. She doesn't know me from Adam, you know, Adam and Eve. She said, I saw a ghost in the wall. And then the manager said, there's a stone out in the back. They had a name for the ghost, David.
Okay.
Yeah, and that, I mean, but it's so weird because you mentioned Hadley. Well, a lot of people mix up Hadley and South Hadley.
All right.
They're right next to each other. But I thought, I says, and so in the daytime, I got there at night. In the daytime, I went up there about a week later, and he showed me the stone circle. It's probably 3.5 to 4 feet tall, not very. And he says, we don't know what this. Well, I'm not an archaeologist. I'm not a stonemason, or, you know. But you never heard of this one?
You know, I'm curious if it's the one that's on the cover of my book in Heath, Mass., which is Burnt Hill. I'm not sure how.
Oh,
far
I know Heath. Yeah, a little tiny town. Yeah.
I'm not sure how far that is from South Hadley, so I may not be familiar.
About 40 miles.
Okay, so that's probably not the one.
It's about.
Okay.
But I have heard of the one in South Hadley.
But you haven't heard of the. Oh, you have heard
of
South Hadley.
Yeah, I have heard of it. Okay. And again, this organization that I worked with and still a part of New England Antiquities Research Association, NERA. They have a database, an extensive online database that their members can access that's just really, really deep. And you can.
Is that members only, or can anyone access some of this info from the New England Antiquities Research Association?
Some of it is available, but to get into that database, you have to have a password that only memberships.
Interesting. And how do people find out more about this organization?
Go to NERA.org.
NERA.org.
They have two conferences a year in the fall and the spring. And a wonderful group of people that I highly recommend people with an interest in this contact.
Frank, thanks a lot. You know, coming back from Maine, I threatened my family that, okay, we're going to stop at this mystery spot in Salem, New Hampshire, which they call America's Stonehenge. And I'm a little skeptical, frankly, but we have about 30 seconds before the break. Tell me about that.
Well, it's a fascinating site. I recommend anybody who's interested go and take a look. It's enigmatic. You don't see anything like this anywhere else in the Northeast. And it's hard to say how much of it. I mean, the site was seriously scavenged in the 1800s and 1900s, where people would just go in there and take away truckloads of stone that was available.
Yeah.
And you have to wonder how much of it was reconstructed and how much of it is original and how much of it is old and ancient. But it is an ancient site, and there have been carbon dates taken from hearths there going back a few thousand years B.C., and there are absolutely walls that align with this pattern of solstice and sunrise and equinox alignments.
It's not too far from Route 495, so if the traffic gets you, you get off there. All right, let's take a break. 800-348-2551 is the number. 800-348-2551. Glenn Kreisberg is here. Spirits and Stone. More of your calls coming up. Vox Pop on WAMC. Ray Graff with you. We're joined by Glenn Kreisberg, author of Spirits in Stone. So you tool around the Catskills often. Do you ever come across things that have not been documented previously by any of the researchers?
I think I do. There's so much out there, and the more you look, the more you find. And
is that confirmation bias, though? Are you seeing things that really aren't there, how do you rigorously sort of separate the wheat from the chaff?
Well, again, you have to look really specifically at the features of the site and like I said, almost a process of elimination. You can tell when you're looking at farm clearing where they just kind of get the piles off to the side, get the stones out of the way so they can do agricultural work, as opposed to something that has an aesthetic value that has somebody put a lot of time and effort and care into building. And you know, in some cases, you'll find donation stones, you'll find quartzite, you'll find hematite, you'll find chert, the type of stones that would have had meaning to ancient people incorporated into these constructions. And that's a good clue as well. Again, just trying to find patterns. And as you say, a lot of it falls into the category of explainable, but some of it you have to kind of scratch your head about and say, that's really unusual.
Yeah.
And when things start lining up, astronomically, that's kind of giving you a hint.
You know, one of the things that I get from your book, and I've read some Graham Hancock books, and I've watched that Ancient Apocalypse, which is a tremendous series, is the sort of universality of it. In the Southwest, in Peru, and all the way down, there is a universality to. We have stone cairns here that sure don't look like random stone piles right in the Catskills. And we know of Native American traditions where this is often burial related or a tribute to the dead. And doesn't it make sense that there would be something up here in the Northeast too?
I think it does. And if you go back to a really seminal book called Manitou, the Sacred Landscape of New England's Native Civilization by Byron Dix and James Maver, they make the case, and they make it brilliantly. And these guys were no lightweights. I mean, James Maver worked at Woods Hole Institute, Oceanographic Institute. He was the co-inventor of the Alvin submersible submarine in the early 60s. Maver He oversaw the excavations in the Mediterranean at Santorini. You know, it was in the front page of the science section in the 1967 New York Times about how they were linking this find in Santorini to Atlantis because it coincided with a volcanic eruption and the submergence of a civilization, the Minoan. And it was, really quite fascinating. So their book, Manitou, which came out in the late 80s, and Byron Dix was a optics engineer for NASA, the Jet Propulsion Laboratory. So these guys studied these sites throughout New England meticulously, and they made the case that Native Americans built these and in many cases incorporated the constructions into alignments with the horizon and events on the horizon.
I gotta say, I'm enjoying the show here. Glenn Kreisberg is our guest. He's the author of Spirits in Stone. We have an email from Rick, and then we'll go back to the phones. Rick says, I'd like to know Glenn's opinion. When hikers are out on their trails and they take the time to build 1 to 2 feet of balancing stones, I'm not sure if it's done for art or relaxation, but I've heard it's not a good idea. Should you leave the rocks where they originally are?
I'm in favor of that. Now, I'm also in favor of art. And a lot of these constructions that you find people doing, and if you walk around on the Mohonk Preserve, there are some places where there are these large boulders, and it's a tradition. People have been stacking little stones and balancing them for generations. But, it's got a place, and then it also doesn't have a place. And I wouldn't suggest doing it on any state or federal land or in national parks or any land that's protected. But, human expression is something that's hard to suppress. And when people want to, balance stones, who am I to say don't?
You know, 1 minute here and then back to the phone. But I want to bring up the turtle effigies. You have plenty of beautiful photos. And I know that there are turtle effigies throughout the Southwest and in other parts of the country. Some of these pictures you have, I'm not seeing it. I mean, are you sure that these weren't just not random glacial erratics?
Well, some of them may be, but the turtle effigies that I've documented, and there's the, what is it called, pareidolia, where we try to make order out of, chaos.
Yeah.
We see clouds that look like Abraham Lincoln, and things like that.
Oh, I've seen that one.
When we're talking about these, we have to be careful not to, stir things up too much and make people a little too crazy about what they may or may not be. Let's go back to his question. I'm not remembering exactly what he was asking me.
I don't know. I was asking about the turtles, but let's just
let's talk about the turtles because this is an important point. And we see turtle effigies. And, of course, once you suggest to someone that it looks like a turtle, it's hard not to see the turtle, but I'm surprised that you didn't see the turtle.
I saw a couple that look, I can see that, but it took some time.
Okay. And that's just a little bit of skepticism, which is healthy. But here's what I want to offer is that in almost every creation myth of Native Americans, there is a turtle character. And so we shouldn't really be surprised to find turtle effigies associated with Native American sites because in their creation myth, as with many creation myths around the world is flooded. There's no place for people to live. It's just one big watery planet. But then at some point in almost every creation myth of Native American tribes, I think almost all except the Hopi, which have, and I don't want to speak for Native Americans because I'm not Native American, but they have a tradition that their founders came from the sky. Mm-hmm. But in local Native American tradition, and in many, the turtle is the character that an animal like a muskrat or a beaver is sent down by the creator to grab a clump of earth from below the water and bring it up and plop it on the back of a turtle. And they just keep repeating that until you have what Native Americans refer to as Turtle Island or North America. Mm. So in that regard, it shouldn't be that surprising to find turtle effigies in association with Native American ceremonial sites.
Glenn Kreisberg is our guest. Spirits in Stone is the book. Back to the phones we go. Joe in Northfield, Massachusetts is next. Joe, you're up.
Hey Ray and Glenn. This is a privilege to hear you speaking about ceremonial stone landscapes. I worked under Doug Harris, Deputy Tribal Historic Preservation Officer for the Narragansett, for a decade and a half, and under his guidance, we got heavy deep into ceremonial stone landscapes. He is the one who brought the USET people, the language, to take a vote on that. So the Turners Falls Airport, I was involved in that too. That was 2008 that they went to the Department of the Interior and got that finding of eligibility for a 16-mile radius of the Turners Falls Airport. But I'd like to share a little bit real quick. One of the ceremonial stone landscape type effigies that really got my attention were serpent walls. And I remember we were working on a high tension line upgrade. We were making sure that the landscape around there wouldn't get damaged. And we found a serpent wall working its way down toward a stream. And in the head of the serpent, down at the low end, there was a cutout where the eye was. And in the cutout, we found residue of pine pitch, which kind of leads me to believe they may have lit the eye up during a nighttime ceremony for that that effigy. It's pretty amazing. But what I can tell your listeners is that if you get out and about and see these things, you can't unknow what you're looking at. At some point in time, you see it over and over again. And a lot of the stone walls that we ran into, I could see there a lot of quartzite was used, but there were small stones that were brought into the wall that had no structural reason to be there. And it leads me to believe that those stone placements were full community events, which included the children, I judge. It's pretty amazing. The landscape is just full of them. And the Mavord and Dix publication got me rolling with it, and being out in the field and getting paid to actually help identify these things is amazing. And we still have yet to get the Massachusetts Historical Commission to admit that these things exist around here, but I've seen thousands of them, and it's really good that you folks are talking about this.
Glenn, I know you probably want to comment, but did you guys carbon date the pitch that you found?
No, we didn't. We were in and we were out, but we did. They did log in the GPS coordinates for all these sites that we were finding. Now, we didn't carbon date the pitch.
All right, Glenn, go ahead.
Well, the pits may have been very recent because some of these sites are still experienced in use and have always been continually used by groups who visit them. And Joe, thanks so much for your call and also for mentioning Doug Harris, who I adore. He's such a wonderful, wonderful person, and we wish him every good thought in the world. And Doug was very instrumental, and he took that book, Manitou, and had it dog-eared and was charging through the woods of New England, endlessly finding and documenting and protecting and, fighting the good battle, as Doug would say, to make sure that these things got the proper recognition and protection they deserve.
Joe, thanks for the call. Let's go to Wade, who is in Big Indian, New York. Wade, you're on.
Hi, Ray. Hi, Glenn. This is Wade.
Hey, Wade.
I grew up in Mount Tremper, and I used to play in the woods behind my house, and I would see these stone piles all over. I think you're familiar with them, because I think recently I saw you were there on your Facebook page, not too long ago. But there were so many of them, and I noticed it, like, that is not a farm area. It's like very steep mountain. Could you just maybe explain some of those, or what you know about those? Because I know they go all the way from the Mount Tremper side all the way around to the Willow side of Mount Tremper.
That's correct, and that's one of the clues that they're probably not colonial or early American, is that the site that you're talking about there, I believe the one up off of Plank Road and Maidstone, which I posted about a few months ago, and it has a giant serpent effigy at its centerpiece, and it looks like it's just coming up out of the ground. But it's built in an area that no farmer in their right mind would ever want to farm or graze their goats or sheep, or, it's just not conducive to agricultural activity. And you see that. That's one of the ways to eliminate that it was colonial or early American, is, would any farmer in his right mind pick this place to farm when there's good land down at the bottom of the valley?
Wade, thanks a lot. Let's go to Albany. Ian, you're on. Hello, Ian.
Yeah, hello?
Yep, you're on.
Hi, how are you, Ray?
Good.
And Glenn, most interesting program. My question has to do with alignments. Early, you've been stating right along that these are aligned to the equinoxes or the solstices or whatever. But we know that the Earth is spinning like a top. It's kind of slow around. So the North Star that we have today is not the same North Star that the Egyptians used to build the pyramids, for example. So how do we know that these alignments are correct that you've been giving us?
This is a very fair
question.
It absolutely is. And what's interesting is you're referring to something called precession of the equinox, which is how the Earth wobbles on its axis, and the point in the sky where the Earth's axis points to, which is known as celestial north, is not a fixed point. And right now it's marked by the closest star, which is Polaris. But if you go far back in time, this pole star about 5,000 years ago when the pyramids were being built was Thuban, which is the third star in the tail of the constellation Draco. Now, these are all circumpolar constellations that are always spinning around that point in the sky known as celestial north, where the Earth's axis points. Now, what happens with precession is on the horizon, the position of the sun backs up through the constellations. These are the zodiacal constellations on our horizon. That make up the zodiac, and this position of the sun on the equinox backs up through those or proceeds through those constellations about 1 degree every 72 years. So just barely noticeable in a human lifetime. But if you times that by 360 degrees, you get about 26,000 years, which is how long that precessional cycle lasts.
Right.
So the relative position of constellations and the sun's position changes in relationship to each other, but the position on the horizon doesn't change. The azimuths remain constant, and we're about 42 degrees north of the equator here. So you have a specific angle to where the sun comes above the horizon on the shortest and longest days of the year, and also where it sinks behind the horizon on those same days. That is very constant. That it would only change due to the obliquity or the change in the angle of the Earth's tilt, and that's a much slower process. So there are many of these sites that are ancient, like on Malta, where there's the oldest solar observatory in the world, and it's still an accurate solar observatory. Everything lines up as it should on the solstices and equinox. So there is not, it would take a much longer period of time for those to be affected.
Glenn Kreisberg is our guest. Spirits in Stone is the book. We have time for maybe one more here. And there have been so many calls and emails, Glenn. We're going to have to do this again, perhaps when your next book comes out. And that's interesting as well. Let's quickly go to Mai and Troy. You're on.
Hi. Question. This is in reference to evidence of Native American structures up here in the Northeast.
Yeah.
My folks have 100 acres. And in Brunswick, New York, and on the property, in the middle of the forest, is a pile of stones that really looks purposeful. And the stones don't look like they don't have any sharp edges. They're all really smooth and similar in size. I'd say it's been a while since I've been back there because of the ticks, but I'd say proportionately, it would be 5 feet by 8. So it's wider than it is tall. And I've always wondered if that could be something to do with Native Americans. How would I even go about finding out?
Is it a singular pile, just one pile by itself?
Yes.
Yeah, that's kind of unusual.
Just one.
Again, as I mentioned earlier, you want to figure out what piece of land, what parcel that's sitting on, and then do some research at the county real property tax office.
Maya, I tell you what, we are out of time, but send an email to voxpop@wamc.org, and I'll put you in touch with Glenn, and he can check it out. But thank you for the call, and thanks to everybody who called in today. This was a fun show, Glenn.
This was, I have to say.
I got to say, if I didn't think that I would drop dead of a heart attack, I would say, let's go. I want to see these in person. I want you to take me around as a trail guide on some of these places.
Well, don't let that stop you.
Really?
Well, dropping dead? No, that shouldn't stop
you. We'll bring a car battery and some cables, and you can jumpstart my heart. Hey, man, thanks a lot for being here. Once again, the book is Spirits in Stone. Glenn Kreisberg, thanks for being on the show.
Thank you, Ray.
Support comes from Bard Summerscape, presenting a new production of Bedřich Smetana's Czech opera, Dalibor, with the American Symphony, led by Maestro Leon Botstein, this Friday at 6:30 and Sunday at 2, fishercenter.bard.edu. The Pittsfield Farmers Market, local food, artisanal goods, and community every Saturday at the Common, 101st Street in Pittsfield. More info at farmersmarketpittsfield.org. At the Hyde Collection in Glens Falls, announcing Community Day, August 3rd from 10 a.m. to 4 p.m. with exhibitions, tours, artwork, creation, live music, and more at the Hyde, hydecollection.org for details. Thanks to you for listening. Thanks to all the callers. I'm so sorry we didn't get to everybody today. We will do it again. Thanks to Zach Malloy, our engineer. Andrea Leong took calls. I'm Ray Graff. Tomorrow, oh, it's been a couple weeks since I've been back, and it's gardening time. Join us at 2 p.m. for that one. We'll see you.